Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome back to Close Reads here on the Searcy Institute Podcast Network. I am David Kern, and as always, I am joined by Angelina Stanford and Tim McIntosh. Angelina, I would have added more pizzazz to your name, but I can't do it first. It's too weird to do the
And there's too many syllables. Plus, it kind of sounded like Tim was about to like launch into the NBA and with that introduction. So I'm okay. Yeah,
We need some like jock jams going on behind us here.
Logan, can you drop
Wow, do not give up your day
job. From Atlanta, Georgia, starting a shooting guard, it's Tim McIntosh.
Man, before I started reading books, that was the dream right there. That's exactly what I wanted.
Y'all don't know. Okay, this will shock our listeners. Right here, you're talking to most valuable player of basketball in high school every single year. Boom.
No kidding.
I was one of the best basketball players in this state. What?
No kidding.
At 5'8".
8.5, yeah. I switched sports. I switched to volleyball and did the Junior Olympic circuit on that. But
oh,
yeah.
Wow, you're a secret athlete.
Oh, I paid Division I. I was a college athlete. Let's delete all of that.
Angelina's a
I do not want that haunting
Angelina's
me.
Angelina's
a jock.
Why would you? No. Being an athlete does not mean you're a jock.
I know.
I was definitely not a jock.
I'm joking. But I'm definitely going to call her a jock. I mean, like, I feel like just to continue teasing her, I'm going to go with this. If it were my sister, I would definitely call you a jock.
Well, I just feel like you guys get very like, you know, we're the sports guys on here, and I just grin to myself like, okay.
why do you hide that, Angelina? That's something to be very proud of.
Oh, well, okay. This be getting way too much therapy on the air. We should talk about the book. But it just sports absolutely dominated my life for such a long time that I had to take a very serious, just cut it off break to redefine myself and to figure out who I was if I was not an athlete. But I'm okay. You know, it's full circle. I'm okay with it now.
Well, I would have done the sports pizzazz for your name, but then I would have had to put you second. And we all know that we don't put Angelina's name second.
No, we do not.
Should we do the joke? Should I set up the joke that I set up last time that we then didn't come up in the recording?
We've lost the moment.
Should we just move on? Okay.
So I think you spring it one of the next episodes.
Okay. Well, we are here to talk about Howard's End, the first book of 2018. We're here to talk about chapters 1 through 5. And before we started recording, both kind of off the air, so to speak, and then also online, Angelina, your initial guttural emotional responses to this book were very interesting. So I want to hear what the experience was like for Angelina Stanford reading the first 5 chapters of Howard's End. I know it's not the first time, but it's the first time in a long time.
It's the first time in such a long time. So I barely remember anything.
Reading them for the first time. And what was happening to you while you were reading this?
Okay, all right.
I don't really care where you were sitting, what you were drinking, and so forth, but what was happening in your insides?
Okay, so I'm not going to set... Okay, inner landscape question.
Okay.
I think it's really funny that in the last episode, I literally said I did not have a heart book of 2017. I was really hoping I got one in 2018, right? So as soon as I... This is how Angelina reads a book. I start reading it. I'm grinning, I'm underlining, I'm grinning more, I'm underlining more. I'm saying to myself, I think I might be crushing on Ian Forster. I think I might be hard here. And I keep going and I keep going. And then I go, oh no, this is love. Love. Love him. I love him.
I mean, is this love like how Margaret felt about the Wilcox boy?
Are you trying to suggest there's something passing about my fancies, David?
Not necessarily in general, but perhaps this time.
Okay, no, but I got excited.
Maybe we don't know yet. Maybe we don't know yet. That's all I'm saying.
I just got really excited in his insight into the two Schlegel sisters. He just has a lot of insight, and I feel like I am such an amalgamation of those two characters. I felt seen all over the place, and it made me giddy.
So I've got to say, on my sheet of paper here with questions that I have for you, I have a question that I'm going to ask Tim before I ask you that is related to what you're saying right there. Tim, are you more Helen or are you more Margaret?
False dichotomy.
For me, it's Helen.
So, Angelina, you say it's a false dichotomy. I thought it was a fun question. Do you see yourself in Helen or Margaret?
Because I think I'm both of them. I'm both of them. Okay. When I was reading, I was thinking, which one am I? And I just, I'm both. I'm both.
So, can I ask you, because our listeners will be dying for me to ask this follow-up question. If I don't, I won't be doing my job very well. Can you explain a little bit about what you see about yourself and Margaret in these early chapters and then what you see about yourself and Helen? If it's too personal a question.
Oh, it's not too personal. I'm just trying to remember specifically.
Because you say way more personal things in this show.
Yes. Okay, so there's a little running joke in our family because I'm extraordinarily close to my children and they tell me things that other children absolutely would not tell their parents. And so my daughter always likes to preface everything she says with sighing and saying, even though you're my mother, I'm going to tell you this. And I always say, don't stop now. So don't stop now, Angelina. No, it's not too personal a question. I'm actually just trying to remember what it was that I saw. They're obviously very romantic intellectuals with a bohemian bent, and just so many of the things that they said were definitely things that I said.
And a history in basketball.
What's that?
And a history in college sports.
Yes. Wow. I'm going to really regret having said this on the air. I feel like this is going to haunt me.
I'll stop. I actually, it makes me like you more. I'm just going to say it.
Okay. Phew. There are so many lines in there about the way that they perceive reality. They're not political. They're harmonizers. They're enchanted by ideas more than politics, especially the father where he says that line, it's better to be fooled than to be suspicious. Like that could be a tattoo I have, but that is so my whole motto for life. I would rather be fooled than be suspicious. I think being suspicious is so awful. When they talk about this realization that there's an outer world that's so mysterious to them and people are like functioning in it. And it's just such a magical, mysterious world of like bills and papers and transportation. That is exactly how I feel about life and my inner landscape and the imaginary world. That's what's real to me. And I look at people who can like the Wilcoxes, like function in the real world. They seem like Gandalf to me. I'm like, how do you do that magic?
Tim, I mean, you said you're more Helen, and I mean, if you want to pursue that angle, feel free. But I am also just curious about your first impressions. Before we were recording, Tim said, Angelina said, that it may not be a Tim Hart book, even if it becomes an Angelina Hart book. Which, of course, a Hart book doesn't have to be a Hart book to be something you can enjoy. But I am curious about you, what your first impressions, what was happening in your inner life as you were reading.
Not much.
So you weren't moved by anything in it.
There were no cowboys in the first five chapters.
I liked the varying responses to Beethoven's Fifth. I thought that was really interesting. but no, if I'm totally candid, I was like, okay, when does the book begin? When does the book start?
Okay, so...
And I'm over here like, Ian Forster knows my name and he's singing it to me.
Well, okay, so it's funny because I actually feel... I don't know if sympathy is the word, but I like can kind of empathize with both of you on this because
I knew right away it wasn't a Tim book. I mean, like first paragraph is like, oh, this is not fun for him.
Wait, David, what were you, Who's that going to say?
What I was going to say is I sympathize with what you're saying, Tim, or I empathize with it because there are times when it doesn't, you know, like you do kind of feel like, when is it going to begin? Like, when is the actual action going to start?
Yeah.
And as I'm reading it, I was kind of like, this is Tim's going to say, when does the action begin? but I do think this is a book that gets it. It's a book that is tightly plotted. And so it kind of takes some time to unfurl, to unravel itself. And it's like, it's very formalistic. It's like, it's playing with the form, the kind of the Edwardian in a 19th century novel. It's playing with what's going on there. And it's transitioning us to this newer world of the novel. So it's a very, in a lot of ways, I believe it is very formalistic even as it's playing with it. And I think that does unfurl. So I felt like, I felt myself asking, like, what's the point of this? Or why does this matter?
Yeah.
But at the same time, I was enjoying the way he's so playful with language and the way he's playing with the form and how weird and confusing and hilarious and fun these female characters are. And the way they're making, like, just the way they're, I don't know if I would say that they're teasing, but the way that they look at the world and people around them. So I was enjoying that along with Angelina. And I was also wondering, when I think it's going to get started with you.
I appreciated the very last paragraph of chapter 5.
Right. Yeah.
It seems like, okay, this is what we're going to, this is what this book is going to be focused on. I'll read part of it. I'll read the whole thing. For that little incident had impressed the three women more than might be supposed. It remained as a goblin footfall. And that's a reference to, it's Helen, right? Who hears goblins in Beethoven's Fifth. It remained as a goblin footfall, as a hint that all is not for the best in the best of all possible worlds, and that beneath these superstructures of wealth and art, there wanders an ill-fed boy who has recovered his umbrella indeed, but who has left no address behind him and no name.
Yeah. Well, we're certainly getting, you know, like, he doesn't, one thing he doesn't waste his time doing, Tim, is setting out his themes for us.
Right.
From the get-go.
Right.
And in fact, you could argue that he's not subtle enough about it in some ways.
Oh, I love that though.
Well, and I was going to say,
I love how it's structured, how it's paced. I loved his storytelling. I like his voice.
Well, that doesn't necessarily, that's not inherently a bad thing to not be subtle. I'm just saying there's an argument that could be made that he could have been more subtle, and different people will have different opinions on that. But I also think that that is where he's playing with the form of the novel.
I'm also not going to pretend Dickens for a second, subtle. Though, that I'm being objective here. I'm completely personally enchanted.
Well, I don't think...
Well, isn't that the point?
Have to be, yeah. if we were just looking for objectivity on this show, you probably aren't the two people chosen.
No, definitely not. Definitely not.
I don't think I'd be good at hosting or being on a show that it was just like about being objective about, just looking at a book objectively. Like, there's a place for that, but I don't know that that's the purpose of this. I mean, entirely the purpose of this show.
I joked a couple podcasts ago with you, David, that the version of Howard Zinn that you found and mailed me has all of these literary critical essays at the end. Yeah. A critical history of Howard Zinn, page 295. Post-analytic criticism, 313.
This so is making me want to cry.
I know. Right.
Well, like I said, you asked specifically for a book that didn't have any writing in it, and it was the only one I could find that had no markings in it.
No, I'm not going to read any of these, but I do just find it interesting. So psychoanalytical, cultural criticism, feminist and gender, Marxist and deconstruction. Those are the four kind of angles. And I'm getting like opinionated in my old age. I think part of the reason that this show is so fun is because I know none of us that I can detect really have like an agenda with regards to kind of like the critical lenses that we wear. We're all Christians, so in that way, it's a critical lens of a sort. But I don't hear Angelina like really getting into, I've got to like hit that Marxist theory really hard, or I've got to hit the feminist theory. You know, David's got to hit the feminist theory really hard. And that's part of the reason that I think the show is so enjoyable is that we're all completely we all like read the books for the pleasure of it. And
right.
For me, all of those critical theories are all about sort of cutting the pleasure of reading away so that you get, so that the book becomes a political piece or a social cultural piece. And it becomes sort of like a tool by which people can kind of like move their agenda in the world. I'm being very jaundiced about critical theory, but that's increasingly kind of how I see what critical theory seems focused on. And
Well, I will say,
I could not.
No, yeah. I completely agree.
Yeah, yeah. I will say that I'm really into the idea of you writing a play that has a character that's based on Angelina, who is completely into Marxist literary theory. I think that should be.
Oh, wouldn't that be fun?
I feel like you haven't been listening for the last 3 years. I've heard that come out of my mouth. But you know, while you're talking, I'm reminded of C.S. Lewis's essay, An Experiment in Criticism. And I think about this a lot as sort of my standard of what is it I'm doing when I encounter a work of literature. And you know, he says, yeah, if you're trying to distill a work of literature to its universal truth, so this Marxist truth, or this feminist truth or whatever, he says, you're not experiencing the work, you're using it. I think that's what you're talking
about.
Yeah,
right. That's perfect.
We are both just really resistant to using art for some agenda.
Yep. Yeah, and so what we're all
even
trying to
do. Even if it's a Christian agenda, I will say, and throw that out.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. Agreed. Absolutely.
Yeah, so what we're trying to do here is we're having a collective, we're making a collective attempt at experiencing a book and then sharing what we're experiencing.
Yeah. Yes.
As opposed to trying to make a collective attempt to either argue about or persuade people to believe in a specific theory about a book.
Yeah.
We're just
and to make the book
together.
To make the book do something in the world as a cultural artifact, you know, as a
right.
To make E.M. Forster the mouthpiece for whatever we want to name it, Marxist critical theory. Oh, look, he is undermining the capitalist order. And by doing that, we can say going forward, capitalist theory is harmful to the human soul. No, 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 no. I mean, sure, if he does that, let's let him say it.
Right.
But he's the book has got to be more than that.
Well,
absolutely. I mean, there's no question that there are themes of gender and economics in this book. I mean, we see that in the first five chapters.
Yep,
but to expect that he's like a propagandist or that he's pushing some ideology onto us. See, if he's pushing ideology, it's not art, in my opinion. It's something else.
Well, and even if we had a book that we knew that the author was a noted, well, let's just say we could read a Virginia Woolf book and read it and just try to seek out common experience in it, right? Or try to have a collective experience.
I have read all of Virginia Woolf's novels. She is not a propagandist. There's plenty of things to talk about.
Well, right. So, but there's it. Well, yeah. I didn't mean to lump her into like some.
No, but I hear what you. She's definitely a favorite of the feminist lit crowd. Yeah.
Right. So we could read a book that is commonly understood in a certain way, and still just pursue a like common experience in that book. Even if we're experiencing it different ways, I mean, common like for the group, like we're sharing our different experiences and having a common discussion on it, collective discussion on it. So like I've thought long and hard about whether we should read books on this show that are fundamentally proposing ideas that we all completely disagree with, or that are just very problematic. And so should we read those and then discuss them, or that our listeners would just completely disagree with and be angry most of the time you're reading it? It's probably not worth it. It's probably not worth being angry while you're reading it. But there is something to be said for reading those books as a work of art, as an experience in and of themselves, and just trying to figure out things for ourselves rather than like he can be saying something that we disagree with and still create a work of art that is worth experiencing.
Yeah. And if he says something we disagree with, maybe that's cause for us to reevaluate what we believe.
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. Well, let's talk a little bit more about Howard Zinn. Angelina, you talked a lot of, you used some very specific words of things that you liked that are things that I enjoyed and I think are worth talking, and maybe we can convince him to come around on them. you talked about things like pace and voice, and those are vague but still specific formal ideas. Can you talk a little bit about
vague and specific, my specialty?
Well, there are specific things that are vague until we dig down a little bit, right? So specific things vaguely spoken about. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean by the pace? I've got lots of thoughts on voice that I want to kind of turn to, but I want to hear what you have to say about this pace idea first.
Well, it's definitely Edwardian. Okay, so a Victorian novel is going to have a much, much longer build up, first 100 pages, and you still haven't even met all the characters. I mean, talk about like laying out the themes methodically, slowly. And the whole story is going to unfold a lot slower. So this feels Edwardian. In fact, I kept thinking about Virginia Woolf novels while I was reading it. She's a contemporary, as well as a friend of his. And so it's the same sort of pacing. And so it's got a lot of the trappings of the Victorian kind of stuff, like we saw with Brideheads, but it jumps into it just way, way faster. I mean, we literally jump into a conflict that you would not see right. That in a Victorian novel. Very, very slowly build up to that. So that's a much more modern pacing, right? You just jump right into the conflict.
Yeah,
which I guess is an ancient way too, right?
Yeah, you're in the middle of the Trojan War, 10 years in.
That's right. And I don't know. What do I want to say? I feel like everything I'm going to say is so vague. I just felt like it's moving along in a nice little clip, you know? Boom, boom, boom.
So Tim, you did not feel that pacing is the case, or you felt the pacing was okay, but you didn't feel like enough, like there was anything actually happening? Or did you not care about
more the latter. I was curious about, so the beginning of the book, Helen has, we learned by letter, fallen in love with a young man.
Well, Margaret, it's Margaret, right?
Margaret, excuse me. Wait, is it Margaret?
No, Margaret's the older one. Helen's the younger one.
Right? And Helen is the one who's fallen in love, right?
Yes. Helen is the younger one who fell in love. Yes.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
So
yeah,
Helen's fallen in love, and then Mrs. Forgive me, Munt goes to kind of rescue her. And we learn a little bit about how Helen has fallen in love with this young man. And then she kind of steps back after they realize it's not going to happen. Helen sort of steps back and she looks at the young man and his family who previously had charmed her. And now she's not as charmed. And it struck me, how did it strike you guys? It struck me that Helen was kind of like, oh, he's not one of my people. I was enamored by the way that the way that their family lived. I was curious about it. It was different. But then she kind of stepped back and realized, but just because it's different doesn't mean that it's me. And now returns to London and she seems like she is returning to her element, not just London, but we find her again listening to Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, this beautiful cultural event. And we also discover this other young man who we're not quite sure. Is the young man going to be interested in Margaret? Is he going to be interested in Helen? Is he going to be interested in neither? So I feel like the setup is there. And I also, there's like the nice little undertones of a sort of form of life that it seems like E.M. Forster is recommending to us through the family. There's kind of a form of life, the way that they approach people.
So you,
that I found really compelling.
Which family?
The, what are Helen and Margaret's last names? The Schlegel family.
So you, that they're, okay. Yeah, I didn't know. I was just making sure you weren't talking about the Wilcoxes.
Right. Yeah, not the Wilcoxes. Did you guys read that the same way?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Helen was initially attracted to the Wilcoxes because they were kind of like they were country. Oh, how charming.
Well, it's a little bit like what we saw with Brideshead Revisited, right? The Wilcoxes seem so capable and navigating a world that's so curious to her. And so she's drawn by their power and their confidence, and she lets them dominate her sense of self. She gives up all her opinions for their opinions, and she's completely enamored with them. And then when she's the whole bubble just bursts, and she stops being enamored with all of them and realizes this is just crazy.
Well, so the book has a lot to say about imagination. So it says,
oh, yes, it does. I love those passages.
In chapter 4, it says, the truth was she had fallen in love, not with an individual, but with a family. Before Paul arrived, she had, as it were, been turned up into his... So, okay, here's the thing right now. The light my lamp, someone stole my light bulb and I didn't know it. So I am using my computer light to read in a dark room.
Cozy and romantic.
Yeah. It's not a candle, Angelina. Before Paul had arrived, she had, as it were, been tuned up into his key. The energy of the Wilcoxes had fascinated her, had created new images of beauty in her responsive mind. To be all day with them in the open air, to sleep at night under the roof, had seemed the supreme joy of life and had led to that abandonment of personality that is a possible prelude to love.
That's a great line. That's a beautiful line.
She had liked being told that her notions of life were sheltered or academic, that equality was nonsense, votes for women nonsense, socialism nonsense, arts and literature nonsense, except when conducive to strengthening the character nonsense. One by one, the Schlegel fetishes had been overthrown, and though professing to defend them, I'm reading like a 10-year-old, she had rejoiced. This goes on and on, but she had created new images of beauty in her responsive mind is a line that I think is key to what's going on here, because the world is changing so much. And it's forcing people to think about each other and to think about the way they live in different ways. And I think that what's happening is these women, these young women, are open to being tuned in a certain way. And so the question is, that kind of person is empathetic and sympathetic and fun to be around and
full
of joy, but also easily manipulated, right? And so that's part, to me, that seems like part of the conflict, at least of the early portion of the book, is as we're getting to know them, are they going to be manipulated in that way, or are they going to be easily manipulated into losing their ideals? Or are they going to be, is that imagination going to be tuned, so to speak, as the book uses the word, in a way that is more positive? And that's, I don't say anything else at this point, but I don't know if I maybe it's not a conflict, but it's at least a question.
In a Victorian novel, this whole setup of she gets carried away with her imagination and she kisses this guy and says she loves him and, you know, writes off to the family. This is very Sense and Sensibility-esque,
yeah,
right?
I was going to say that, yeah.
Typically, she's going to be condemned, right? This is going to be seen as a foolish act. And her older, wiser, more sensible sister is going to set her straight, except her older, wiser sister is not the least bit more sensible, which I loved. And Helen is totally not condemned for this. You know, she's not ruined because of it. She's not going to go like waste away and be ill because it happened.
Although in some ways it seems like her aunt would want her to be the older generation.
Oh yes. The aunt is definitely the older generation.
She
who is being portrayed by Forster as out of touch with reality too.
Yeah.
She's out of touch with reality, with the economic situation. Her advice is actually harmful. So he's definitely setting up this old new conflict. And I don't know, I could be reading this into that. So you guys can correct me on that if you didn't feel like that. But I kind of felt like the whole Helen scenario gets treated like, oh, well, every woman has to be an idiot once. Let's carry on.
Yeah, I took it that way. I took Mrs. Munt's response to the fling, the affair, whatever it was, I was impressed by her. I didn't read it as someone who is out of touch, but
really?
Yeah, but I would like to, I mean, I wouldn't mind finding that and reading it, because I fully admit I may have read it.
Okay, so I'm basing a lot of that on all the details about how her financial advice was bad, but she couldn't see that it was bad. And she prided herself that she had quote unquote saved the girls' finances, when really she had given them very, very bad advice. And what they were doing on their own with the new risky investments was far more successful than the old reliable British investments, which were slowly whittling away their fortune. So I took that as a metaphor to her, how her relationship to the world and to the girls is on a larger scale.
Now that may be true. I was thinking specifically of when Mrs. Munt hears the story of Helen and what's the boy's name? Wilcox boy, Paul.
Yeah, when she reads the letters there in chapter two, or hears about the letters.
No, it's when I thought it was after Helen kind of recounts the collapse of the relationship. This might need to be edited out because I read this a week ago.
Well, I think she is an interesting character because
Mrs. Munt.
Yeah, because for someone who is at least ostensibly sort of supposed to represent this fading away, I mean, at least that's how I took it. I don't know if you guys took it that way, like this culture that's now fading away. She, it's interesting that he calls her, or he says about her that to history, to tragedy, to the past, to the future, Mrs. Munt remained equally indifferent. Hers but to concentrate on the end of her journey and to rescue poor Helen from this dreadful mess. And then it talks about how her perspective on these places, she doesn't, you know, she looks at them with inattentive eyes. She's unimaginative. She doesn't see past the obvious surface of this, like the train station, for example. There was,
it's, oh yes,
the station,
yes, yes.
Like the scenery, like Helen's letters struck an indeterminate note. And she sees, oh, this is new, but she doesn't understand what that means, or she's not looking past the surface of it. So she, like I said, ostensibly is supposed to represent this fading away of the past, but then at the same time, to history, to tragedy, to the things that make up imagination, or that kind of feed the imagination, she is ambivalent about those things.
Yes, that's a very good distinction. I'm glad you made that, because I don't think that what Forster is doing is pitting the past against the present, because he has some equally damning words to say about modernity.
Yes.
And it's the same way. It's all about what kills the imagination. And Mrs. Munt's economic advice is bad because she lacks imagination. And the same thing where he condemns Germany, which at that point would have been, you know, the representation of the up-and-coming modern world.
Right. So the Germany stuff was really interesting to me because my grandmother's family, my grandma was the first person in her family to come to America. And this was in like 1950 or whatever after the war. She came from just outside of Berlin, and she's still the only one of her family that ever came over here. So my dad's cousins and stuff were all in Germany. And in the 19th century, their family, the Brockhauses, was a wealthy aristocratic German family. And they were all doctors and politicians. And one of them was actually married to Wagner. And so they were part
kidding.
Of the, like late 19th century world of like they wrote the dictionary, the German encyclopedia that was popular at the time. So they were like that academic world that he's comparing to the British here. They, like they were the kind of people who would have been like thought of they were the kind of people that unfortunately fed the perspective that led to Nazism. And the idea that Germany was this like God chosen people that was the only proper, they were the only proper people to rule the world and so forth, which I mean, I'm completely oversimplifying, but that perspective certainly came from late 19th and early 20th century German.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. It's interesting that shows up. It starts to show up in the book, the kind of German nationalism. And there's kind of there's an allusion to an English nationalism also. Gosh, is it late in chapter 3?
Oh yeah, when the two sets of relatives, you know.
Yeah.
Each of them thinks that they're God's chosen nation and they can't
that.
That was brilliant. I also thought that the descriptions of Germany just read like America though. Right? The obsession with only what is useful. Money is useful. Mm-hmm. The imagination is not useful. And also an obsession with bigness. Right?
Yeah.
It's the vice of a vulgar mind to be thrilled by bigness.
Yeah.
That's not imagination. No, it kills it. Man, those are some good lines.
Yeah, those are good lines.
One of my favorite lines. My other favorite
line. Just a little bit of. Go ahead, David.
No, go ahead. Continue the thought.
I was just going to talk a little bit about the rise of nationalism and late 19th century Europe. Man, I just said that sentence, and as soon as it came out of my mouth, I was like, what are you talking about? I would like to talk about the rise of nationalism in late 19th century Europe. I'm like, oh man, everyone in like listening distance just fell asleep. Good night, everyone.
Let me know when you're done, and I'll come back.
Bedtime podcast. Yeah, we'll be back in 10. Let us know what's
done. See you in 10. David, please salvage this.
No, go ahead and say what you were going to say. Just don't say it boring. Well,
that's right, Tim. That should just be a motto from now on. Say what you should. Just don't be boring.
I would like to talk about. Okay. Just really quick, there is this kind of movement in the late 19th century. A lot of it is a response to Napoleon taking over the world.
Right.
the Germans are making themselves distinct from the French. Everyone is kind of is hoping that they can preserve their identity. And there's this big question of, well, what exactly is identity? Where does it come from? And in the 19th century, most of the conversation was about language. Language is the thing that sets us apart. And there's something about the German language that makes us Germans us. It's a little bit less that way, I believe, in England, but it's that way also in France. There's something about French that makes the French French. So that's part of where nationalism, like the people need to hear this the right way. The kind of nationalism that comes alive and is so aggressive and putrid in the 20th century, way back in the 19th century, it's kind of, it's got some like roots back there. I'm not claiming by any means that the 19th century kind of like interest in, you know, German as the defining feature of the German people, like led somehow to Nazism. I don't believe that, but just historically, there's a little bit of a tie.
But it,
I'm not arguing a cause. I'm just arguing a relationship.
Look, we're talking about ideas of sociology and history about which I know very little, and I'm certainly not an expert. But it does, in some ways, like it doesn't surprise that a certain sense of nationalism would have come out of a world that was so steeped in imperialism.
Yeah.
So like individual nations standing up for themselves, believing in their own greatness, shouldn't be surprising that that comes in response to British and Napoleonic imperialism. Mm-hmm. And that this thing is kind of happening at a crux point when those responses are beginning to take shape.
Right.
And then, of course, you see this. I mean, later on, you see the same thing in response to the Soviet Union. But that's another question for another day.
And I always think that English imperialism, I mean, if there were ever imperialists, it was the English. But I think that sense of nationality is a little bit less pressing in the late 19th century, just because geographically, England is an island. They are distinct geographically. There's just that little body of water called the English Channel. And they don't have to, in the same way, like the United States, we just don't have to deal with a lot of, we don't have to deal with a lot of worries about defense because we're relatively isolated. We only have two neighbors where, you know, Germany is surrounded on every side.
Angelina, are you asleep?
If you're not, Angelina, I've got a brief lecture to deliver on alienation in 19th century politics.
Good. Could you call me about 10:30 tonight?
So
let me get cozy.
I do think, though, that these ideas relate to this idea of imagination and the idea of, because part of imagination, I see if I can put it in a way that makes sense, that could explain what I'm actually thinking here. Imagination is closely tied to how we view ourselves. What one thing that, like, for example, one of the things that we have is this what may be a false dichotomy that he kind of winks at between the imagination and things that are commonplace. So my favorite line in the book, in the first five chapters, is when the young man has come to pick up his umbrella, and they accident, and like Margaret kind of accidentally chases him away.
Yeah,
he calls the umbrella ratty, and he's like freaks out and runs off and all that. And she like faux chases him. At least that's how I read it. But it says that their brother, finding the incident commonplace, had stolen upstairs to see whether there were scones for tea. And I love this idea that like the rest of what they're talking about is commonplace. So I'm going to go check about the tea. It's first of all, it's the most British thing, but it's also like that. I think Forrester's winking at us here because for the brother, for Tibby or whatever his name is, the tea and the scones or the scones or whatever you want to call them, depending on where you live, that is not a commonplace thing. These discussions of the feminine home and what he seems to be considering women issue, like that's the commonplace, but there's intrinsic value, like this intrinsic value in the scones and the tea and like the beauty of them. And so the beauty in simple things is something that seems to even be attractive to Margaret when she goes out to the farm, right? Or goes out to the Wilcox house and she spends time outside with them. Like it's a simple way of life, but it feeds and tunes her imagination.
So well, it's a more physical existence. So for somebody who's all caught up in the imagination, a lot of reality feels unreal. They have, you know, just have a hard time connecting with the physical reality. And so they're being out in nature and watching the way that they are, that would have deeply affected Helen. They would have seemed so in tune with something that feels foreign to her.
Hmm. Yeah. But that kind of goes with what I'm saying. Like the
no, I agree. I agree.
The scones and the tea are a physical manifestation. Like there's something, they're a physical manifestation of a sort of beauty.
No, I'm agreeing with you. So their household is dominated by the world of ideas.
Okay. Yeah. Right.
And so something like the scones would feel special to him.
Yeah. And it probably, as the only guy, when there's these three women downstairs that are bantering crazily back and forth.
Well, he says it's a feminine household. He says that.
Right. So in the midst of the craziness of this feminine household, he seems to find like there's like structure and order in the scones and the tea that is not
also he likes being babied and taken care of.
He does. Yes, he does.
Oh, Tibby.
I was actually wondering if there's going to be something of Sebastian and Tibby. That's one of the things I'm going to look out for. I'm not saying there is.
Secret scone habit.
Not necessarily the extremes that Sebastian takes it, right. But sort of the same sort of role in the book. He warmed the teapot almost too deftly. Let's talk about voice.
That's a great line. Yeah, I'm kind of coming around. This book is like, once you guys are kind of like pulling out some of these gems to look at, I'm like, yeah, this is actually really, this is a stronger start than I give it credit for.
Our narrator.
I want to defend it. Defend it a little bit. Like, I'm just.
Your opinion
of
the book.
I typically warm up kind of slowly. And I typically do. I do absolutely no pre-work on the book. I'm a little bit committed to doing no like historical or critical pre-work on the book. Sometimes it works out extraordinarily well. Sometimes it makes me feel like, oh my gosh, you're missing a lot here. Like you guys mentioned, sorry, Dave, we'll get to your voice.
Yeah.
You guys mentioned that E.M. Forster is writing this about the Wolf sisters, Virginia Woolf and her sister.
Yes, that was before the recording. I said that.
Yeah, I had no idea.
This is where the Angelina take comes out. So Angelina, take us through it.
Well, E.M. Forster was a periphery member for about 10 years, 1910 to 1920, with the Bloomsbury Group, which I guess I shouldn't assume that our listeners necessarily know who that is. But that was a famous kind of literary art set with Virginia Woolf, her sister Vanessa Bell, who's an artist, Lytton Strachey, the poet, John Maynard Keynes, the economist, and E.M. Forster and some other kind of in and out members. And so they were just this intellectual, bohemian, free thinking, progressive group committed to aesthetics. Kind of like a redux of the Pre-Raphaelites, kind of.
Mm. Oh, yeah, that's a better
similar thing.
I want to weigh in about the Bloomsbury Group. My acquaintance with them is largely through philosophy. So G.E. Moore, who is...
Yes, that was the philosopher of the Bloomsbury Group, yeah.
And they invited one of my heroes, Ludwig Wittgenstein, who he and a German named Martin Heidegger are probably the two most influential philosophical voices of the 20th century. Wittgenstein is one of my heroes. I'm not going to defend him on the show. Nobody's like making... No one's like, hey... Can you tell us more about Wittgenstein?
hey, can you piggyback on that nationalism talk?
talk about Wittgenstein. I'm just tempted because I love him so much, but he gets invited a couple times. Have gone off the rails. He gets invited a couple times to the Bloomsbury Group, and he apparently just cannot stand it. So he like drops in and then he immediately drops out. One other thing, just because this is just a nice little nugget, Keynesian economics. So Angelina just mentioned John Maynard Keynes. Keynesian economics is sort of like the modern incarnation of socialist economic theory comes from Keynes. So when people complain, this is not me issuing an opinion, this is just me reporting. When people complain about the government printing money, you know, like if there is some sort of problem with the economy, and when Barack Obama stepped in and printed money to kind of get more cash into the system, that's a very Keynesian move. So the general theory of, I think it's Economics by John Maynard Keynes, is probably, it is the most formative book in modern economic thought. And Keynes is famous for saying, you know, like something like, most people's lives are being run by an economist whose name they've never known. Well, that economist is John Maynard Keynes.
Yes, it is. So they were, then that demonstrates that they were a hugely influential group. And, you know, we can debate whether or not their influence was good or bad, but in their own time, they would definitely have been considered progressives and bohemian and out there. And they explored a lot of life choices that our listeners would probably not be comfortable with.
That was very well said.
But the two women of the group, Virginia Woolf and Vanessa Bell, who were sisters, were friends of E.M. Forster's, and they are the model for the Schlegel sisters. So this kind of bohemian, intellectual, free-thinking family with advanced ideas, advanced, you know, not old-fashioned ideas about gender and et cetera.
Progressive
ideas.
Progressive.
Without any connotation one way or the other. But you know, that's the model. This is the artistic world. So all this emphasis on the imagination and the aesthetic experience, that was all something that was very interesting to the Bloomsbury group.
So my dad the other day, he was my mom was reading the book, and he goes, he's trying to remember which book that is. And he says, oh yes, that's the book about how England is gonna go one way or the other. And the question is, which way are you going to go? And I thought that was interesting.
No, I thought that was Twelfth Night.
maybe this is the follow-up several hundred years later to Twelfth Night. Because, and I think the thing that's interesting, because the Bloomsbury Group and Virginia Woolf and all that, they're sitting at a very important time as things are changing. And what we don't know yet when this book comes out is the impact of the war. That Rideshead does, you know, Waugh had the war to look back on. But this is the same, asking some of those same questions I guess that Virginia Woolf and company, you know, were asking, but at right before the war starts. So in theory, there's like this optimism about what's going to happen, about the world that they're living in. Now we could, and I don't really want to tie that all back into Virginia Woolf, because we could go for a long time on Virginia Woolf's ideas. Maybe we should just spread those out and let Angelina talk about those, because I'm a novice and Angelina knows what she's talking about.
Well, it's been a long time though since I've read that stuff, but I do hear a lot of those echoes. You know, she in her novels also has these like Victorian figures in her novels and tries and the interesting thing is, though, you know, while Virginia Woolf is perceived as this kind of intense feminist, she's not condemning of the women who represent the older world. Just like with E.M. Forster, she's fascinated with the role that these women played at the time that they're in, but also feels like the world has changed. And also there was something oppressive about it as well. So I've spoken so vaguely. I'm thinking of like three different novels in my head, but that was probably not helpful at all. I just mean, she's not, it's not necessarily the slash and burn feminism you might expect. There's some respect for what was good. She's trying to sort out what was good and what needs to change.
Well, yeah, I mean, feminism of 1910 when this book was written was different than the sort of feminism of like 1971.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
It's a different thing. But
when they're talking about equality, they're talking about the women's suffrage issue. So,
right. And Tim, are you still against women voting?
Lichtenstein says no.
Did I?
Wittgenstein, for whatever it's worth, it's Wittgenstein.
I knew I said it wrong on purpose. And you Lichtenstein.
I believe Lichtenstein is a small country in Central Europe.
Were there too many? Was that question too? Did have too many ideas? Too many accusations implicit within it? There, I didn't.
Yeah, it was a little bit. In logic, they would call that a loaded question.
For me, for the last 4 years.
Was that question too loaded? But let's talk about voice.
Tim, are you still kicking? Are you still kicking your dog? It's one of those. It's a loaded question.
Exactly.
No, so you did. Yes, so you are.
Well, let's talk about voice, because this narrator is very opinionated, as you can get in a, and it's a, much of it is subtle. So he's very opinionated in subtle ways. So, for example, he warmed the teapot, M-dash, almost too deftly. M-dash rejected the orange pekoe that the parlor maid had provided, poured in 5 spoonfuls of a superior blend, filled up with really boiling water, and now called to the ladies to be quick or they would lose the aroma. So there's a lot of stuff in here where the narrator kind of stops and turns and starts speaking to us. And he is a very smart narrator. He's a funny narrator. And he, like I said, is very opinionated. Yeah. Angelina, you brought this up as something that you were enjoying. What do you particularly enjoy of our precocious narrator here?
I think I like the chatty commentary nature of it.
Is this a common, is this common to the Edwardian period, or is this something that is another example of him playing with the form and being a little bit more contemporary than would have been common? Is Dickens so chatty?
Well, Dickens is not Edwardian, but the Victorian narrator is extremely different. Not that it doesn't comment, it does, but it does it in this reader. If you have not noticed, this is the bad guy. Also, he's in black and he's very bad. You know, it's not light. It's really heavy-handed, and there's a lot of reasons for that. But George Eliot especially will just grab her reader and slap her for 800 pages. You know? And I like her, and I say that. Just, yeah, did she not write this subtle, they're not... What's that?
Did you write a thesis on George Eliot?
I did.
Yeah.
So I mean, I don't mean that in a bad way. It was just that's just who George Eliot was. She was so fireball. She had things to say. She was going to make sure you heard it.
If you were going to write a novel, to be fair, that's the novel you would have written. It's just not the only way to write a novel.
I probably would have at least one draft where I was slapping my reader. Yes, this is probably true. So I there's something about his lightness about it all, and he's just like
the
deftness
of it.
He's not preachy. He's absurd. I feel like I'm not being talked to. Maybe this is the distinction. With George Eliot, you're being talked to. She addresses you, reader, you, the one holding this book. I'm talking to you. You know, she literally does that. Whereas here, I don't feel like I'm getting preached at. I feel like I'm just seeing inside his mind. And as he's looking, these are the things he's observing and thinking about. So it feels a little more stream of consciousness to me than a preachy narrator. Is that how it feels to y'all?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. As I was reading, I kept wondering, is our narrator going to show up as a character later? Because the narrator feels like it's part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And like it, I'm trying to remember exactly what you just said that made me think of that. But that's how I felt. I kept wondering, 100 pages in, is there going to be this little shift where you somehow meet like that? I mean, it would be a little bit maybe too cute, but that's almost how it feels. Like this person has a
shift, David, like the narrator will take a step back and speak a little bit more in a George Eliot sort of.
No, not necessarily. Frame. More like all of a sudden, 75 pages in, we realize that the narrator is a character who starts speaking about certain scenes in the first person.
Like
this is a friend of theirs, or someone who ends up falling in love with Helen or Margaret or something and becomes part of their lives,
yeah.
Or a butler who's a part of it and then comes back. And I'm not saying that's going to happen. I don't even think it would necessarily be a good idea. But the narrator is so much a part of what's going on that it feels like he or she could be. Does this narrator feel masculine or feminine to you?
In the section that you read, it felt masculine. Gosh, I don't know though.
I'm having a hard time answering that too. because my first thought was, it sounds like a man who really understands women. But maybe I just think of that because I know a man wrote it. But it feels like he just understands the head of Helen and Margaret really well. And he does it in this non-condescending way. He doesn't pat their little heads. Even when they're being kind of silly, admittedly. I think he's sort of enchanted by it.
Oh, that's
oh, I get the impression that he's enchanted by them. Yeah, I think so. You know, one thing I noticed about the narrator is that he is very close to the action, but he is not, he's not landed on any particular character. Maybe he's closest to Helen, but we also get a long time with Mrs. Munt when she's, you know, taking the ride out to the Wilcox's farm. We also get a long time with Margaret when she is the guy's name Sebastian? Do we have a name for the one whose umbrella was?
We don't have a name for him yet. He didn't leave his card, so I won't say.
He whose card was left, Margaret. You know, there's a long time where Margaret with him, and we even have a long. We have some time with him. You know, he's worried about trying to understand these ideas and trying to fit all this culture in his head when he is. He thinks of himself as an unrefined man or maybe uneducated.
I loved that scene when they were walking back to the house. I loved it so much. I loved how she would say something and then there was this, they would just awkwardly look at each other. And then say, if she was like other women at this point, she would have said this and then he would have said that. And then she would have said this, but she's not like other women. So they just looked at each other and I was like, oh yeah, that's my life.
I love the part where it's getting inside his head too. Her speech fluttered away from young man like birds. If only he, and then it gets into his, like it gets really into his head. If only he could talk like this, he would have caught the world. Oh, to acquire culture. Oh, to pronounce foreign names correctly. I love that jump there. Acquire culture, pronounce names correctly. Oh, to be well informed, discoursing at ease in every subject that a lady started. But it would take 1 year with an hour at lunch and a few shattered hours in the evening. How was it possible to catch up with leisured women who had been reading steadily from childhood? His brain might be full of names. He might even have heard of Monet and Debussy. The trouble was that he could not string them.
It's Monet, David. It's Monet.
Monet and Debussy. The trouble was that he
could not. What has gone into you today?
The trouble was that he could not string them together into a sentence. He couldn't make them tell. He couldn't not quite forget about his stolen umbrella.
That was awesome.
Yes,
all the anxiety that keeps him from being able to pursue beauty. That was a great line.
I know. And look, it's great here. So yes, the umbrella was the real trouble. Behind Monet and Debussy, the umbrella persisted with the steady beat of a drum. I suppose my umbrella will be all right. He was thinking, I don't really mind it. I will think about music instead. I suppose my umbrella will be all right. Earlier.
That was wonderful two sentences.
And then like if you jump ahead a little bit, there had always been something to worry him ever since he could remember, always something that distracted him in the pursuit of beauty. For he did pursue beauty, and therefore Margaret's speeches did flutter away from him like birds.
I think this might be a good time to mention something that might not be readily apparent to our listeners who are modern Americans. There are so many subtle class distinctions in England that we don't have here. And so our education system, even the mass production of clothing, yes, you still have regional accents, but television has largely kind of leveled, you know, the American accent in a large way. So we still have these things, but on a much, much smaller level. Whereas in England, see, this reminds me of Theodore Dreiser's book, Sister Carrie, because he pays a lot of attention to all these tiny little class differences because the character Carrie is trying to brace herself up in the world and you can't because you have to overcome all these things that she can't, these class differences. But all of these, like, The different, he would be wearing clothes that would immediately identify him as not of the same class because you can't afford, because everything's custom made. You can't afford the clothes they have, right? His speech would have immediately given him away. These would have been things that he literally could not overcome. England does not have, as part of its mythology, the self-made man. That's an American thing.
Right.
And so I think when we're Americans and we read these books, we don't understand why he's feeling this tension. Why does he feel so out of place talking to this woman? So why does this seem so insurmountable? Why does he run off in shame because his umbrella is in tatters?
Right.
One of the great reasons, little hint towards the next book, one of the reasons I wanted to read True Grit, or at least read a Western following this, is because of exactly what you're saying there. Like, the self-made man can spring out of a place that is more enamored with the idea of a Wild West than it is with the idea of order. Mm-hmm. If you're culturally enamored with the idea of order, then it's much more difficult for that self-made man idea.
Well, the self-made man's a threat to the order.
Right. But then in True Grit, in the West, in the American West, you have a counterpoint to that. So I wanted to read them next to each other because I think
that's very clever.
Archetypal ideas that are kind of, or constructs, if you will, that are kind of going back and forth and can have a conversation with each other. So that's just a preview to the next book.
Angelina and I are kind of like, just, we got our nose in this particular narrative that E.M. Forster is telling us, but David is like, he's the grand narrative maker.
He's four books ahead of us. We don't even
know. He's four books ahead of us.
You and I have, love when people on the Facebook page are asking us what book is coming.
Yeah, we're like,
you know more than I know.
Let's go with this line of thinking. I'm in favor of just keeping up with this. Can you say more about this, please? About how I am the puppet master and know exactly what I'm doing.
Yes, that's exactly what Tim said. You are the puppet master.
You're the puppet master. We're on your strings, man. Oh,
and my legs are so tired from all this jingle jangle.
Well, do we need to call it a day then? Should we just end this episode and pick up where we were next time?
Seems appropriate. Seems the right time to close shop.
Let's go ahead and just see. Do you guys have any final thoughts as we go on to chapters 6 through 10?
My only final thought is just to continue the last thought I had about that this male, unnamed male character. His interests, what he's drawn to, these finer things, artistic things, beautiful music, good literature, and he's spending money to encounter those things that he really can't afford. So this will no doubt be something Forster is bringing to our attention, that what about the person who longs for this life that they feel shut out from? How do you handle that? What does that mean?
Yeah, I think that plays into this idea that my dad brought up, which I'm interested to see how it works out. The idea that England's going to go one of two ways, and where are you going to be? In other words, who is going to participate in the way that it goes? Like, who's going to be left out and who's going to be included?
This is a contemporary conversation too. Like, who is art for? Is it just for the highbrow intellectuals, or is art for everyone? It feeds into all of that.
Which might be a more obvious answer to us Americans, or like our obvious answer to 21st century Americans is going to be different, to your point, than it would be to an English person of 1910, even to a poor person who is going to be thinking about themselves differently.
Very much so. Yeah. He's not only going to have to overcome external obstacles of money and class, but internally, you can see in his internal dialogue how much he feels unworthy to participate in this. It's just so foreign.
There's conditioning that's bad that goes on in the thing.
And in that sense, it's a little bit of a parallel to what Helen is experiencing with the Wilcoxes, right? Drawn to this foreignness that you feel shut out of.
There's something about these two women that he's enamored by, but it's like they're scary as well. How do you interact with someone who you barely get? Like, everybody has that person who they probably had a crush on or whatever, that like you had a crush on them because there was something mysterious and magical about them. But when someone is truly mysterious and magical, or you think they are, how can you possibly know how to interact with them? Like, you have to have an insane amount of confidence, and the more confidence you have, the less magical and mysterious other people can seem. So I think that's interesting. Tim, do you have any final thoughts?
I don't. I feel like I said that I was going to be bored by this book. I don't think I will be. I think I'll like this book.
Well, I've definitely been happy to see, because I, for the first time, really, I had a lot of people were on there like, why are we reading this book?
Is it just because they never heard of it?
Possibly. I don't know. I don't really know that it matters. I mean, I have no problem with someone questioning the choices that are made about the books that we read. But I'm glad also to see that people are saying, oh, I get it now.
Yeah, as soon as I started reading it, they were saying that. Tim, I'm very happy to hear that you think this might not be a torturous experience for you.
No, I know it won't be torturous. I mean, just because by its reputation, the fact that David chose it, I knew that it wouldn't be a torturous experience.
So the final
reason...
It's just,
you know, it's the conversation. It's like, books of manners are not my heart books. And I'm going to act like I'm going to talk about Dmitry Karamazov again, and I'm not. David?
You are such a tease.
No, I'm not trying to be a tease. I have so many thoughts and feelings about Dmitry Karamazov, and I just don't even, there have been requests on the Facebook page to finish my thought, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I just don't know that I can. It's like a volcano might set off. Sorry, I did not mean to make this about me.
I love that. The episode David, in which Tim makes it all about him.
Yeah, right, right.
What I was going to say to wrap it up is just that the, unless Tim, I mean, you can have the floor.
No, done, done.
I do have a few follow-up questions about nationalism.
Yeah. Oh, wonderful.
2017 actually was the year of Howard's End in some ways. So BBC One actually did a 4-part TV miniseries where they remade this. That came out in the fall. So I think that that's all finished now. I don't know exactly. I don't know if it's available on the PBS website or the BBC One website, but it is out there. I'm sure it's at worst you can get it on demand somewhere with a lot of interesting cast people. I think Matthew McFadden's in it and Hayley Atwell and like people like that. So that'll be something that people can watch along with it or watch ahead of time or afterwards or whatever. And then also the movie, which came out in 1992 and for a long time was kind of, you know, it was Merchant Ivory, and some of the quality of the video was not great. It looked like a 1992 Merchant Ivory movie. But they've since, in 2017, they restored it, or at least they released a 25th anniversary restoration. So now it looks amazing. So if you watch the movie, find the restoration version and you can see young Emma Thompson in all her clarity.
should do that. If we talked about doing a bonus episode, David, where we talk about the movie, we should watch the restored version.
Yeah. I mean, it's just going to be a more enjoyable version. So, you know, it seems that there was some sort of a Howard's End renaissance. Guardian in the UK, the newspaper, also wrote a few things about the book tying when the BBC One series came out. So there are a few articles and things like that that are out there that you can pick up, and if you're so inclined. So it seemed like a good moment to do it.
Yeah, we never mentioned that Howard's Inn is considered to be Forster's masterpiece. It is, you know, he wrote a lot of things. Yeah.
Right.
This is considered his masterpiece.
Yeah, he was very successful. He wrote
To India.
Passage to India. Yeah, yeah.
That and was a Room with one. View.
And a Room,
yeah, with a view.
All of these things have been made into movies.
Starring Meryl Streep and Helena Bonham Carter.
Mostly Helena Bonham Carter, yeah.
Yeah.
She is so personally thankful for Ian Forster.
No doubt.
So anyway, that's all I have. Is that it? I mean, you had your final thoughts. Do you want to?
I'm happy and content.
See any angles? Okay. You have any more?
We should stop while Tim is happy and content. Yeah. For however long this might last, let's preserve this moment.
Well, Tim, it's playoff time. So good luck to your Atlanta Falcons this Saturday.
David, thank you. I was heartbroken on Tuesday morning. All those who need to know probably know what I'm talking about. Oh my gosh. The Georgia Bulldogs.
You were heartbroken and I was just angry. I was just like, I was angry for you. I wasn't really angry, but I was, you know, sports fan angry.
you know what the hardest thing is? It's like I loved the guys on the Georgia team. I just loved those guys. Yeah, and they fought so hard. I mean, they just fought so hard. And I think Alabama was a centimeter better than Georgia, and they won.
And they had some luck along the way.
And they had some luck, they did. And I think if the ball had bounced a different way, Georgia could have won it. And I just was like, oh, those guys just worked so hard. I just wanted a payoff for all that work and character. I just loved that team. I was so sad Tuesday morning.
Fourth down that they converted down in the red zone where the quarterback, he was not throwing it to the guy within 10 yards, to anybody within 10 yards. He
My buddy Andrew said the exact same thing. And I was like, no, Andrew, I think it was a great throw. David, I think it was a great throw. No, I really
do. There's an angle where it shows who he's throwing to. And when you see the angle, there's absolutely no way that Calvin Ridley was in his line of sight.
Really?
He's behind three people and he just throws it up to the guy in the back line. And Ridley just does an athletic move and goes and gets it. I don't think that he was throwing it to that guy.
Wow.
But I just said it publicly, so maybe the quarterback's going to come out and tell me I'm wrong now. But
yeah, maybe he is. He's going to tweet you.
Yeah. If that happens, it means...
This is actually the part of the show where our listeners are going to take a nap. No, I don't mean that meanly. It's just that they always on Facebook say they don't know what we're talking about when we're talking about football. This was a football game Monday night was deeply invested in.
Tim's team was playing in the national championship game in college football.
I haven't won a national championship in 37 years. This was a moment for us.
It's just been a hard couple of years to be a Georgia football fan.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's been a hard 37 years.
But hey,
you're talking to someone who grew up with the 1970s New Orleans Saints. I feel you. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, listen, you have the Atlanta Falcons, or as Graham calls them, the Atlanta Falcons, have redemption available to them.
Good.
The narrative this weekend can change, right? They can.
Good.
They can,
I love it, David. I love
story.
It.
It's a new story starting this weekend.
See, you are the big narrative guy.
Against the Philadelphia Eagles.
The Eagles.
Look how you are such a good director for Tim. Look how you just draw all this emotion out of him. And I'm just like, you're going to have to stop telling me what to do. And Tim is just like, loving it.
And Tim, they're going to win.
I love it, David.
I believe the Atlanta Falcons are going to beat the Philadelphia Eagles this weekend. And I do too, actually. Change.
David, do you have a good prophecy about me that does not involve a football?
Well, I had one about the Saints.
I don't really care.
I believe that you are going to have a dream sometime in the next 40 days wherein it is on the night of a high school basketball game and you're supposed to be playing, but you can't find your uniform.
Okay, this is a curse. Ooh. I also have a recurring dream of going through the cafeteria line and dropping my tray at the end. Thanks a lot.
I have a prophecy that the lost sports uniform is going to replace the cafeteria.
All right. Just be forewarned, when I wake up in the middle of the night in a panic sweat, I'm texting you and waking you up.
I will not wake up from a text. That would not be possible. You probably would have to come to my house and then throw one of my children on me, and even that might not work. All right, well, that we should probably wrap this up because this show is going nowhere very quickly. Thank you to everyone who's been listening.
Been a weird one.
Thank you to everyone who has been supporting us on Patreon. If you want to learn more about how you can do that, it's patreon.com/closereads. And we have lots of great content, podcast content coming out in the next few weeks, so be on the lookout for that. I guess that's it. Angelina and Tim said they had nothing else to say. I don't really believe them. There's this tension that feels like it's going over the internet right now that I'm supposed to ask them again, but I'm not going to. So for Angelina Stanford, for Tim McIntosh, and for all of us here at Cersei, thanks so much for listening. This has been another episode of Close Reads on the Cersei Institute Podcast Network. We'll talk to you next week.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. and they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.